Hello, everybody from the nation's capital. Welcome to an episode of the Politatine Podcast. My name is Damon Galvin, and as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Max Kalman.
Yeah, I'm glad to be back on.
Yes, we're very excited for the episode that we have to bring to you guys today. I want to start off by saying that this episode will be the first part of a two-part series that we're going to be doing on unions. We at Politatine and the Ox Institute want to say that we stand in solidarity with the writer's strike, as their strike is not legally over at the time of this recording. Further, we would also like to voice our support for the UAW and SAG after strikes and all those engaged in union activity. Always remember that united we bargain, divided we beg. Also, I was hearing some developing news earlier today that I think the hospitality union for Nevada is going on strike, if I'm not mistaken. But I'll look that up as we dive into this conversation and also get some more information on that. But if that is the case, we do stand in solidarity with them striking as well. Before we jump into that, I think there's a lot of personal anecdotes that come now, especially particularly with the writer's strike, as we've been writing scripts for Politatine.
Oh, definitely.
And it really shows the significance, the importance of writers, because even when you have so much assistance with AI nowadays to help you with scripts and whatnot, you still need that human touch. And
oh, definitely.
Especially when you're doing something so creative. Like, it's one thing to be a fact-based show. We're a fact-based show, so it's a lot easier to use the assistance of these AI models to get whatever information we need, fact check it, go on, write a script. But the creativity that is required to create shows that we consume every day and take for granted is basically unfathomable.
Yeah, exactly. And so much of what the writer strike was about was that the large companies who were they're currently actually still negotiating with, pending the results of their tentative deal, were trying to implement AI for a lot of the writing they were doing, and were looking into means to do that. But at this point, it's not nearly advanced enough to reach anywhere close to the creativity of an actual person, not to mention an experienced writer who's been working on shows for decades.
Of course.
And I mean, on top of that, there's still the open question of whether AI will ever be able to do that. And as well as the fact that, I mean, I think people always, now and forever, are going to appreciate a human touch in something. I mean, it's, you know, as well as AI can try and replicate us, there's a level of humanness that perhaps even comes in the errors we make.
Yeah.
And some of the nuances that I don't think can really be replicated.
No, definitely not at all. And also just connecting with someone's work, understanding that there's a real person with real lived experiences that shaped the writing style that we so much appreciate. And then also, you know, I'm from Atlanta, so we constantly deal with the pilot strikes there and the picket lines, and I haven't gotten the opportunity to join one yet, but I definitely look forward to doing that, because I know that pilots are some of the most active unions, especially with Delta being headquartered there in Atlanta. But with that being said, let's talk about what part one of this two-part series is going to be.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm really excited. We're going to delve into a lot of the history of unions, strikes, the gains in a lot of cases that workers have made, and the immense amount of pushback that they've gotten from corporations as well as the government. So I mean, to start, union strikes have had a long history in the U.S. The earliest strikes date back to early 1800s, but it wasn't really until the late 1800s and into the early 20th century that unions began to have a major impact on American society. There was a wave of union organization at this time with strikes, workers fighting for better pay, hours, and working conditions.
Yeah, and so I guess we'll just dive in by talking about the first strike that we really found of note, and that's the Homestead Strike of 1892. So this was actually a strike against the Carnegie Steel Company Homestead plant in Homestead, Pennsylvania. This was a strike that we've been talking about over the past couple of days, and it was absolutely ridiculous. There was 12 strikers killed and 70 security guards. But this is going to be a pattern that we're talking about a little bit here as we delve in the reasons for these people striking. It always seems to be along the same lines, even, you know, if we're talking early 1800s, 200 years later, and if we're talking late 1800s, early 1900s, 100 plus 130, yeah, 120 years later. And in this case, they went on strike to protest wage cuts and the company's attempt to break their union, which we still see so much. But what was really notable about this strike, and if you want to even dive in a little bit more about this, was the fact that they essentially hired a militia.
Yeah, they hired 300 Pinkerton guards, which, fun fact, they're the villain from Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, the most stereotypical of, like, these people were literally the hired guns who they sent over to go literally kill,
yeah,
people who were on the picket line striking for really basic things, like working hours and, like, better working hours, better pay, protesting wage cuts, like you were mentioning earlier. And, you know, all these basic demands that they had were met with some of them being killed.
Yeah. Some of them being killed. Some of the militia members being killed.
Yeah.
It really goes to show the greediness of corporations, the extent that they're willing to do, the extent that they're willing to go to essentially ensure that their profit margins stay higher and continue to increase. But obviously, this goes down as one of the most violent labor strikes ever, and it wasn't at the hands of the people picketing. It was because you bring in a militia to break up this picket and to get people back to work.
Yeah, exactly.
But again, it just attests to the extent that corporations and the government, because the government also does get involved here.
They end up sending the state militia.
Yeah.
To restore order. And, you know, in a lot of these cases, what you'll see is a combination of private union busting,
yeah,
which is the attempt to mitigate strikes, unionization more broadly. And again, you see it happening privately from a lot of these large corporations.
Yeah.
But a good majority of the time, they're also able to involve the government to try and aid them in shutting down a lot of these organizations.
Yeah.
So in other examples, we'll see there have been multiple times where the one form or another of the military was sent in to effectively
These unions.
Exactly.
Literally. And it's something that we're going to see as we get into more present times. And I'd like to say the desirability of violence kind of has gone down in recent times. I don't know what the data has to say on that, but obviously a corporation hiring a militia to break a union strike probably wouldn't go as well today as it did back in the 1800s. But
yeah, I mean, nowadays what you see is they use the government, but entirely through the legal system.
Yes. Yeah.
So they will spend probably more money than they spent on these militias,
yeah,
in lawyers,
yes,
to flood these strikers, unions, and, yeah, any attempt to organization with a tremendous amount of lawsuits that a vast majority of the time they do not have the resources to combat.
Yeah, so let's just look at this alone. Last year, Amazon by itself spent more than $340 million on union avoidance advisors. Jesus Christ, what a tongue twister. Union avoidance advisors. Just Amazon, $340 million. So this, the process of trying to avoid unions, you can imagine the industry is in the billions. Corporations are paying billions of dollars annually so that you don't get to unionize.
Yeah, exactly. And so much of that is the fact that the corporations, they have the structure and the funding to be, yeah, able to organize and collaborate against the organization and collaboration of unions. And even of unions working together to a lot of times reach very similar aims over a wide variety of industries.
Yeah, so in this case, you know, this union was obviously defeated. They got sent back to work, and they didn't win any more rights. But it did demonstrate two things. It demonstrated that American workers had the desire to have their material conditions improved, to be treated with dignity and with respect, and that they were willing to come together and advocate for these changes. But it also demonstrated the other side of it, the level and the extent that corporations are going to break unions, the willingness of violence to break these unions and to break the activities. But it's just one of those situations where you see this so much continuity in future cases.
Yeah, definitely. And speaking of, we can get into our next case that we have laid out here. The Pullman strike of 1894. This was a nationwide strike from railroad workers against the Pullman Company. It was eventually broken by the federal government.
Yeah, who would have guessed it?
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
But it helped to raise awareness of plight of workers, led to the passage of fairly important labor laws.
Yeah.
I mean, even the history of unions in terms of, even despite all of the vast organizing that's done to thwart them through union busting, have still made very significant gains in terms of the everyday life of workers around the country. I mean, unions were the first people to advocate for, you know, having weekends.
Yeah,
and for limiting the amount of hours you can work a week,
which now seems
making full time.
Yeah, now seems like too much, but yeah, making 40 hours of work week the standard, and 8 hours a day, and the 9 to 5s. These were all
advocated for by unions.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
A lot of them were made in either exclusively or in conjunction with union movements.
Yeah,
and union organization.
Yes,
and this is another example.
Yeah, and like the previous example, these were started because of wage cuts, which I don't think we see as often today. We don't see wage cuts in the classical sense, but we had been talking earlier about how there's a wage cut essentially with inflation.
The idea is that if they do not raise your wage to the same extent to keep up with inflation, you're effectively getting a pay cut every year.
Yeah.
So a lot of times, even when you get a promotion or a pay raise, it still will likely be under the level of inflation, meaning effectively it's a pay cut because the money that you're making is worth less than it was the year before.
Yeah.
And this is very consistent now, especially with more and more rising inflation. But more traditional wage cuts have been in place for... have happened from large corporations to try and save their bottom line for
what we see a lot more often nowadays, though, is the latter. You see a lot of layoffs. A lot of corporations send out these emails. There was this case, and I can't remember it off the top of my head what the company involved was. Maybe you can.
Twitter? No.
No, I mean Loki, but no, there was another company that I think it was last year. They literally just get like 1,200 people on a Zoom call, and they're like, "Yo, you are fired." Like their CEO just hops them on a Zoom call and just lets them know that, like, "Yeah, we're downsizing or downscaling or whatever they call it." Right? They just use whatever words. You're all fired. You have health insurance for the next 30 days, and that's it.
Yeah.
And so we see a lot more of that. And obviously, as corporations have grown larger and larger, it goes from like cutting half the company isn't cutting 20 people. It's cutting thousands of people. And it's absolutely devastating. But again, this is another case where they were defeated ultimately. But as you said, it helped advance changes that were necessary and served as kind of a catalyst, if you will, in this circumstance.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And I mean, this was a major strike that was seen by, you know, workers across the United States. And help to raise awareness that, like, actually, if you group together, you can fight, you can work for better conditions. It doesn't have to be this way.
Yeah.
I mean, the workplace is a situation where Americans broadly love democracy and political system, But in the system that dominates your day-to-day life, we just accept an authoritarian boss who gives us our hours, tells us our pay, and essentially decides everything that we have to do.
Yeah.
And
we spend one-third of our lives in the workplace. Yeah, one-third of our lives. And the other third, we spend sleeping.
Yeah.
So essentially, we spend, half of our waking moments at work.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Which is unbelievable.
Crazy. If you work 8 hours a day, and then you sleep 8 hours a day.
Yeah. And think about the amount of your day-to-day life that's actually dominated by...
Yeah, and then you come home.
So minimal.
You come home and you have to think about the fact that you're not getting paid enough, and that you might get fired, and that the company's downsizing, and that your wife's sick, and you're gonna lose your health insurance, and you have a kid on the way, and you need a pay raise. Yeah. So it's like all of these things where even though you're working effectively 8 hours a day, you're thinking about work in almost every aspect of your life, and it's not in a positive manner.
Oh, definitely not. And I mean, because no matter what, because of the world we live in, your day-to-day is thinking about money. Am I going to be able to afford to pay rent this month?
Yeah.
And since the vast majority of Americans now, and has been a fairly consistent trend throughout our history, live paycheck to paycheck, meaning that they can't afford really any emergency payments.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they miss one paycheck, they might get evicted.
Yeah.
And it's a very dire situation for a lot of workers.
Yeah.
And this is also what, in my opinion, make strikes such an honorable thing to do.
Oh, yeah.
Because 100%. The whole initiating of a strike is them saying, we are not getting paid enough. Our conditions are not improving at a fast enough rate. And for them to be willing to accept no pay and go on strike for an extended period of time with very minimal to no compensation at all from the union, depending on its financial standing, is... unbelievable. It's remarkable. And it's one of the most honorable things to do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. 100%. And the other side of this too, is obviously I was using examples for, you know, people that have a family and whatnot, but even as like a college student, right?
Mm.
Our cost of tuition has gone up threefold since the last minimum wage raise. And a lot of people use this argument of, oh, well, like the minimum wage is for like high school and college kids. And it's like, even if it is, it's not enough for them. It's not enough for us.
Look at the fact that like when the vast majority of university students need to take out loans.
Oh, yeah.
These loans, a lot of times people need to supplement their federal loans with private loans, which can have interest rates of 10% and up.
Yeah.
And even 12%.
Yeah.
Which are meaning that if, let's say, you don't get a raise at whatever job you're working at, or you miss a paycheck, that could lead to substantial losses in the long term, because you're going to have to take out more loans for your university payments. And in the down run, that loan could be worth thousands and thousands of dollars that you're going to be forced to pay off.
Yeah.
And guess what? You won't have any money to put to pay off those loans because you're working paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah, but this strike in specific, to go back to it, was also notable because it played a role in the development of the American Rail Union, the ARU, and it was actually led by an interesting historical figure, Eugene Debs, and we were talking earlier about how there's even some continuity in the fact that that we're mentioning Eugene Debs with contemporary issues because... Eugene Debs, if you guys don't know, which you should Google, do some research on Eugene Debs. But again, research this individual, absolutely amazing. But he did run from prison. And we might have a presidential candidate this year that does the exact same thing. So just even more continuity. But yeah, obviously the ARU is extremely significant. It was one of the first industrial unions in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And it inspired other unions to follow suit. So that's always a positive. Again, collective bargaining is such a strong tool. But what's even better than collective bargaining is more collective bargaining. Like more a larger collective is always better. It's always more effective. And it's something that might even be worthy having a conversation about in part two, because there's this concept of a general strike. And when you have teacher union in California striking, and you have the American auto workers striking, and you have auto workers in Germany striking, and you had SAG-AFTRA and the WGA, and then in Nevada, and all of these different, you have, you know, unions being set up across the country for Starbucks and Amazon. It's, when does this come a huge collective bargaining situation? But
yeah, exactly. We can totally let's save it for part two.
Yeah, we definitely will dive into that,
because you know, we have a whole podcast of material ready
yeah
for that.
Yeah, exactly. But no, so the next one, fittingly enough, does deal with auto workers, and this is the Flint sit down strike. This went between 1936 and 1937. And it lasted 44 days. And this is actually, it's a little bit different from the other ones that we've been talking about, because the boys came out with a dub on this one. So yep. they got some change. They got some change made. They wanted better pay. Who would have guessed? They wanted better working conditions. Wow, never heard that one before. And they wanted their union to be recognized. All things that I think I've never heard before. Very creative and unique ideas, but
yeah, exactly. we never see this anymore going on today.
Yeah, right. This is such an old dude. Imagine
if this were relevant at all to what's happening.
But this also goes to an interesting point, and something that I've commented on before in my works. It's one of these interesting talking points that the Heritage Foundation provides for us. But James Shirk at the Heritage Foundation talks about why union membership is declining. And instead of accrediting it to the fact that Amazon spent $340 million to make sure that there are no members in the unions, he accredits to the fact that unions have not been updated since the Gilded Ages of the 1930s. He has some very, very, very interesting talking points, but he ignores the fact that unions have a 71% approval rating. This was according to stats produced literally last year. Can't imagine how much better they are now that, maybe we'll talk about it in the contemporary episode, but how much better they are now that Joe Biden becomes the first president in the United States, first sitting president in the United States history to join a picket line. But yeah, he's quoted as saying unions designed their system for the industrial economy of the 1930s. Yet the approval rating in the 1930s, guess what it was for unions? 72%. So he lost 1% favorability. Yeah, no. He's right. His argument's good.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Because
that 1% difference.
Yeah, the 1% difference. Been... Yeah, over almost 100 years. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, and the other thing that like they just don't account for at all is that, I mean, we're seeing this in the history we've been talking about so far, and maybe one of the other case studies we're going to get into, but unions have been fighting for the same things since unions started fighting for things, and you know, and fighting against the same corporate rule where they're trying to reduce their cost as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And this comes out in reducing your pay, your benefits, extending your working hours, all for the sake of the bottom line.
Yeah.
And this is not a new issue. And unlike the Heritage Foundation would like you to believe, it's definitely not an old issue.
Yeah. No, exactly. That's the thing, right? And that's kind of the irony when we're bringing up all of these examples. And let's look at why SAG-AFTRA and why the Writers Guild and why John Deere, why all of these people striked. They want better working conditions. The UPS especially was a very good example of this. They wanted better pay, they wanted better working conditions, and they wanted their union recognized. Like,
yeah,
this is a perfect example. But again, he just doubles down and claims in this article, and this is something that I was just so, I spent so much time dissecting every single point that he brought up. I just couldn't help but bring it up on this podcast, especially because this happens in the 1930s, so I felt like it was so fitting. But he goes on to claim, and I still cannot find to this day where he gets this number from. I don't know, but he says that 1 in 10 employees not in a union want to join one. Only 1 in 10. However, research from like Pew and all of these other very respectable research institutions show that 43% of Americans say they would vote to join a union or vote to unionize if offered the opportunity.
Yeah.
So I can't find where this guy gets this number.
Lord knows.
I've looked for it absolutely everywhere, and it genuinely just seems like a made up statistic.
Yeah.
Like
I would totally believe that.
It's absolutely ridiculous. And The Bureau of Labor Statistics even backs this up, like backs up the other statistics by individual research institutions by reporting that there's been a 53% increase to establish unions
over
the past year. 53% wow. increase.
Wow.
So from, I think these numbers were from 2020 to 2021.
Wow.
A 53% increase to establish unions.
Wow. Because I mean, that's extremely significant over a 1 year period. And I mean, for a very long time, you know, we haven't seen a lot of major strikes happening until recently, where we've seen a huge revamping of union activity, union power, union organization. And like we're seeing with a lot of major strikes, we're seeing a very significant upturn in union activity broadly, which is amazing.
Yeah, no, 100%. Let's see. Yeah, just I guess two last things on just dunking on Shirk here. It's also important to just consider the fact that, and this is such a simple explanation that I overlooked in my research, but more jobs are being created. And when more jobs are created, you have to petition for a union. So if more jobs are being created exponentially now than ever historically before, then there's just going to be less union members because there's more jobs. Therefore,
yeah.
The overall number of union members goes down when more non-unionized jobs are created. But yeah, this guy's, frankly, I don't know. I don't want to say anything super mean about him, but...
Ridiculous.
Ridiculous is a good way
ridiculous
to put it.
Ridiculous argument.
Yeah, this guy
Let's
has...
keep it simple.
Yeah, this guy has some preposterous claims. How's that? How's that? But no, yeah.
Speaking of, if he wants to come on the pod...
Yeah, if he wants to come on the pod, please, we'll absolutely, please. Absolutely we have him on the pod. But... did you...
What?
Did you hear that? Did you hear that? I think that shows that it's time for a segment that we like to call... Oh, I missed the button.
Base Biden.
Let's go. Welcome to the first segment of Base the Biden. This is a segment where we're going to be talking about right now some of the base things that Joe Biden has been doing. Hyping up the boy a little bit, making sure that he's getting in his daily hype, I guess. So this is a segment that we're also going to counter with another funnier one that we'll leave for you guys to discover in future episodes. But yeah, Based Biden. I won't miss the button next time, but let's hop in. I need to get it on a soundboard. I need to make a hotkey for it so that anytime that I'm doing homework, it's just I accidentally hotkey and it's just Based Biden.
Yep.
But yeah, go ahead.
This is the perfect episode to do
to start it off with too.
Yeah, to start off with Based Biden segment, because I would say the most based Biden is in regards to union. I mean, he has a very strong pro union record. I mean, he's called himself the most pro union president in American history, and as far as I can tell, that's not too far off.
I don't even know if that would be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, to clarify, I mean, we glossed over it earlier in the episode, and I wanted to emphasize it here. Just the other day, he became the first president ever.
First sitting president. I think presidents prior to becoming presidents.
Okay, sure. First sitting
possibly,
president.
Yes.
Go
I know it's one of those annoying like, things, okay. But it's like, when you listen to the White House press secretary be like, he's the first sitting president, it just makes you think about it a little bit more. But regardless, I think
sitting president,
that's
to still, go to a picket line and talk with the workers there and talk about his support for what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, like we've said previously, the government has typically been on the side of the corporations a lot of these times when it comes to union busting activities. Various of the examples we brought up, the military came in to personally shut down these unions.
Also, I think something that's significant to mention here is that he's also doing it as part of his reelection campaign strategy.
Mm.
And we also saw Donald Trump. I don't know. Did you get to see the Donald Trump stuff where he was like, just tell your union bosses, vote for me. just tell them all, support me. I'm the president. I'm the pro president, pro union president here. But he was just absolutely,
he didn't even go to the picket line. No. Went a few towns over and was close enough. And,
okay. I don't know if I read this wrong, but I kept reading it over and over and over again. The rally that he held was at a auto parts store that sells specifically non-union created.
Are you serious?
Yes.
So it was this is honestly honestly perfect Trump. That's the most ideal Trump is ever doing. When like
can we get a fact check on that just to double check me? Yeah. Jamie, pull that up. But no, I kept looking at it. I was like, there's just no way. So also what I was thinking, because I didn't get to look at the whole thing, is he just, I just don't know if he's anti-union. I don't get it.
That's the whole point, because he doesn't have any specific policies that he actually cares about.
Okay, but this was supposed to be a base Biden segment. We love Donald Trump here.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's the current sitting president.
Yeah. Trump urges UAW to endorse him in speech at non-union car parts maker. Like, isn't that absolutely absurd?
Oh my god, that's ridiculous.
That's so insane. But anyways, okay, back to Bay. Well, hold on. Let me get back to
Base Biden.
Let's go. All right.
So, I mean, yeah, back onto this topic.
Yeah.
Don't.
All right. We're good. All right.
Biden has appointed a variety of pro-union officials, actually, to key positions in his administration.
Yeah.
You know, this includes Labor Secretary Marty Walsh, who, unlike previous labor secretaries, resigned to go join the corporations that they were fighting against.
Yeah.
He actually resigned to join the union for NHL players.
Yes. Yeah.
Which I think is
NHLPA. Really
cool. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, sets him apart and actually shows where Biden's at in a lot of cases, where he's not just bringing in people in the, you know, the various departments that deal with union government. He's not just bringing in people who are, you know, mediocre, who are just going to go retire into lobbying or supporting corporations. He brings in people who go on to then work in the unions.
Yeah.
And I mean, this brings in as well, he's really beefed up the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB.
Yes.
For the main body that deal with regulating unions, and especially regulating union busting and trying to combat a lot of those efforts, which many are illegal. You know, there are methods of union busting. All union busting is highly unethical, but a majority of union busting methods that a lot of these corporations use are actually illegal.
Yes, yeah.
And,
so,
I have a stat. The government regulatory body.
Stat to back it up, already pulled up, ready? So the Economic Policy Institute found that 41.5% of all union election campaign results in employers being charged with violating federal law. 1 in 5 results in a charge that a worker was fired illegally.
Wow.
1 in 5. And then 41% is just there's
illegal activity.
Yeah, illegal activity.
From on the side of the corporation. Wow.
And this is just in election campaign. Like, this is just in the campaigning, the union campaigning, let alone
not even
strike activity, picketing, all of these different things. Just the idea, the concept. Because when a lot of these violation happens, and there's a very good example here. I actually don't know if I wrote about it, but I can remember it off the top of my head. Let's see. Yeah, I think that I had to remove it for to consolidate.
Yeah, just go for it.
The article, but it was a Starbucks employee who essentially was bringing to the table with her peers and her colleagues, like, hey, why don't we unionize? And she got fired when she started bringing up the idea of unionizing. She got fired for texting to ask her supervisor when she was scheduled, which she had been doing for months at this point. But technically, under Starbucks rules, you're not allowed to text a supervisor when your schedule is or whatever. So she got fired because they found a technicality that she violated. And again, this is the other difficult part of it. That's illegal because obviously they're firing her not because of the technicality. They're firing her because of the fact that she wanted to unionize, or else they would have fired her months ago.
Yeah.
And then the other part is that it's not illegal. That's the worst part about it. It's not illegal because they fired her with cause.
Yeah.
So while we're sitting here and saying that it is illegal because it's immoral, because it's wrong, because it should be illegal, the reality of the situation says that this can't qualify as something that's illegal because it's not.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it goes into the fact of who can prove it better in court, the multi-million dollar corporation or the, you know, single person who gets fired for even thinking about the idea of a union.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of times they don't have the ability to fight these legal battles to prove in a court of law that actually the real cause of why I was fired was my union activity and not this arbitrary stipulation.
Yeah. Well, going back to end the base Biden segment here, we'll definitely bring it back for part two.
I have a couple of things that I want to throw in
part two? Let's throw them in part two. Get to this.
Think?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because you can't guess what time we're at on the recording of the podcast.
Don't tell me.
Guess right now.
25 minutes?
35 minutes. We're at 35 minutes on the recording of the podcast. So we can save those, bring those, throw them back into the base Biden segment part two. So if you want to, you guys want to catch up,
if you want to tune in, hear another eagle squawk.
Yeah.
And,
a little here. Well, you know what? We'll give you the satisfaction to end the segment right here. Get the little eagle screech with our
base Biden.
Oh, yes. Chris. Clean every single time. But we'll be bringing back that segment in future episodes. Maybe not every episode, but every once in a while. But especially for episode two of this two-part series. But hopping back into it, I think the most interesting, crucial strike that we have today, and the last one that we have to talk about, is the Memphis Sanitation Worker Strike of 1968.
Mm-hmm. So here, do you want to get into that a little?
Yeah, I'll hop into it. So this strike lasted for 65 days. I was looking at the other ones, and ended with something that we'll jump into a little bit, but let's start with talking about why the strike happened. First and foremost, sanitation workers were crushed. There was two sanitation workers that were crushed by, the vehicles that they're using, the trucks and whatnot. And that's obviously not good. So they wanted to strike for better working conditions, they wanted better pay, better benefits, safety.
Wow.
And union recognition. Oh, wow. God. We got all four on the bingo card right here for, or is it five on bingo? Four? How's bingo work? I'm not white.
Something like that.
All right, bet.
P-I-N-G-O.
Five. All right, we got it. We can count. Let's go. But yes, so this...
You don't gotta be white to count.
No, you don't gotta be white to count. Yeah. February 12th, this is when it started. We went from 1968 to April 16th, 1968. Mm-hmm. But a notable figure here, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah.
And
idol.
Dr. Martin Luther King, our whole idol, unless you were in the 1960s where his disapproval rating was 90%. But anyways, all of our idols today, King Martin Luther King. This is something that isn't talked about in history. I think it's glossed over. And it's essentially...
Mentioned at all.
It isn't mentioned at all. But... Dr. King was assassinated for his activism as a workers' rights individual, not for his racial activism. Mm-hmm. He was assassinated, even though, yes, historically this was a mostly African-American strike, a mostly black strike. That doesn't take away from the fact that he had been advocating, and the reason that he was ultimately killed was for attending a strike, not attending a race protest.
Yeah. Where was he killed?
Yeah.
At this strike.
Yes.
The one that we're talking about here.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, when you look at, you know, the causes of why he's killed, you know, you need to look at the fact that, you know, Dr. King is a very holistic figure that gets entirely boiled down to his work with race,
yes,
which obviously was fantastic and made a lot of strides. But at the same time, his work in terms of workers' rights more broadly, which he saw as, you know, one of the other most important issues that faced his day, and probably the most important issue that faces ours, is the fact that workers are not, do not have the power to combat their bosses, corporate owners, for basic rights.
Yeah.
And things that everyone should have. And so, you know, this is what I admire him the most for, is the fact that he was a very multifaceted figure on a wide variety of issues.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And I think that the way that the biggest example, right, it was what, the 60th anniversary of the March on Washington this year. The biggest example of just how much it is overlooked and how much it's condensed is that when you think about the March on Washington, you think about the March on Washington, you think, oh, this is, you know, you think of his I Have a Dream speech, you think of, you know, oh, it was for race. The March on Washington was for race. Go watch footage of the March on Washington, and you'll see how mixed that crowd was. Beyond that, the March on Washington wasn't called the March on Washington. It was the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Something that we take off the end because we want to forget that it was for jobs and freedom.
Yeah, this reminds me of another propaganda that was done with the Black Panther Party, who also, a lot of people just think of them as like a violent terrorist group.
Yeah.
But one of the main things they did was run like community food drives and community education for segregated areas that didn't have any real funding for food, education, and other basic things that they needed. And the full title of the Black Panther Party was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. Mm. Because at this time, which is still true to this day, perhaps not to the same extent, you know, unjustified police killings of Black people in this country were unbelievably commonplace.
Yeah.
And the whole premise of the Black Panther Party was self-defense against illegal killings of Black Americans in these segregated communities.
Mm-hmm.
And again, a lot of these are washed down and whittled down into aspects that don't fully encapsulate the extent to which the issues that Dr. King and that the Black Panther Party talked about back in their time.
Yeah.
Many of them are still relevant to this day.
Yeah.
But all of the issues that are still relevant are not talked about as part of, these groups and these individuals who were extremely prominent activists.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And it's an issue that we're definitely going to end up dissecting a lot more in part two of this series. But with that being said, this is going to bring a close to the first part of this two-part series again. Be sure to check out the second part of it if you've made it this far. And if you're interested in all the things that Politatine and the Ox Institute as a whole is doing, be sure to head over to oxinstitute.org. With that being said, Max, thank you so much. This was an amazing episode. And
yeah,
an
thank
absolute,
you for having me on. I enjoyed this one a lot.
Yeah, it was an absolute pleasure to have you on. And to all the listeners, thank you for joining us for yet another episode of the Politatine Podcast. Goodbye.
Bye.